Yeah, a really good one.
Yeah. I don't mind saying so myself.
You keep it interesting, Bob.
Yeah, that's a good line. Bob keeps it interesting.
I wonder if your relationship with Ion is causing you to find... I don't know if it's just because you're talking to Scott Woods or because you're evolving your language, but I guess I said it before. The risk of repeating myself, you know, in the past you were given the big picture and big generalizations.
Yeah.
And now you're filling in a lot of details within that superstructure, and it's fun to hear.
Yeah, but it's my topic. I've read a lot of rock criticism. You know what I mean?
Oh.
It's just something waiting to happen.
Mm-hmm.
He's giving me the details, the matter to look at, but I know how to talk about it. It sounds like it's details. It is, but it's... don't know if I could do details on physics.
Yeah.
I could read Sarfatti, but, you know, mainstream stuff. But Sarfatti's a little crazy, so you can read it. But mainstream stuff, it's too hard to read. You know, and I'd remain general. I'd still stay general.
Yeah.
Whereas this stuff, especially Meltzer, because what he's writing about, I know, so I can make it particular. I think that's the way you say it.
When did you first make the connection that Finnegan's Wake was rock and roll?
Probably when I really started to understand it in the 70s or 80s, when I really... I didn't read it through till 1975. That was the first time I read it. So,
what would be the common denominator between rock and roll and Finnegan's Wake?
Well, you know, in the Jesuit, the priest who writes the article about the shortwave influence on Joyce, he talks about the squallings and static that happened in shortwave radio in the 20s. And he says that's what Joyce is showing in the thunders. They're actually sound noises, you know, sound claps, distorted sound. So you asked me, so rock and roll print, that's a squealing guitar, electric guitar. Each thunder is a squealing guitar, so to speak, among many other things, but you can put that in there.
Right.
Update the just... static from...
Specifically, are you referring to the feedback when you talk about the squealing guitar?
Yeah, feedback, the distortion.
Yeah.
That's what, you know, people read the thunder and think it's a whole bunch, and they try to babble it with their mouth, blah, 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 blah. They think it is univocal. They think it's their mouth. They don't know it's a scream from the car whizzing by. They don't put urban landscapes in that Joyce is describing.
Mm-hmm.
See, it couldn't be any loud noise, but I update it to rock and roll, since that's our present squealing environment back then, in the 70s. So, you can't make out the words in rock and roll. Well, you can't make out the words when you read Finnegan's Wake on a certain level. That's another way it's rock and roll in print. You know, people, you can sort of just get glimpses.
Yeah. He pointed out that the rock and roll, the acoustic, the ear gets loud to compensate for the numbing of the eye or the numbing of the central nervous system.
Well, the classical music is the ear getting super massaged.
Compensating for the eye.
Yeah. Now, today, tactilely, the central nervous system is numb, so all the senses get loud.
The visual, too?
Yeah, all senses get loud.
How does the visual get loud?
Thousand books, endless articles, endless magazines, skyscrapers was the beginning, but you see, people think the Global Theater tactile massage is a visual culture because they watch color TV and they watch movies, it's all spectacle. They don't know, you know, we mean something different with the eye. But the in general terms, the culture got loud, because take any movie from, what was that one with Dustin Hoffman, and the guy, the fucking hobo in New York, Ratso, what was that famous movie? Midnight Cowboy, okay. And by the time of the late 60s, in movies, they would show the urban landscape by showing the billboards and the noise and the cars whizzing, you know, collage of visual impressions, right?
Yeah.
Okay. That is actual color and tactility. But most people say, well, that's the eye, and it's the eye, and the urban environment has gotten loud. It's, you're just bombarded by advertising and billboards.
Yeah.
Right? So there's the visual, but to be in McLuhan jargon, you know, the eye is abstract visual space. It's just that, but also McLuhan predicted we get flooded, drowned in tons of visual space. That's just the endless books.
Right. Well, there's two kinds of imagery. There's the imagery that you're referring to when you're being bombarded by the urban
landscape.
Landscape. In person or in the movies, let's say in the movies.
Yeah.
Okay, there's that visual effect. Then there's the visual effect of reading about it and then evoking the image in your mind's eye, but not really seeing it with the physical eye.
Yeah, with the color, the photography.
Yeah, but you might, in your mind's eye, evoke the color and even the photography to some degree.
You fill it in when you read. You're filling it in.
Right.
So
is that, do we lump all of that in, both the physical eye seeing and the mental imagery from the symbolic text, we call all that visual space? We just lump it all in the same category.
No, because movies and the urban environment is kinetic. It's moving visual space behind you, beside you. When you read a book, you're sitting, it's stuck. It's stopped. It's static space.
Yeah.
Visual space is static. It's a unique space. So reading a book, you can imagine it all you want, but it's a static, stuck experience.
Right.
And it's black and white. But when you walk down the street or watch movies, there's all that kinetic movement going on.
Right.
You don't get that physiologically in a book.
Right.
So you call, McLuhan said color is tactile. So you're starting to move to the kinetic tactile with movies and billboards and color for the eye. It's a tactile eye, not a visually biased eye.
Mm-hmm.
It's a multi-sensory eye. It's like primitive man had. They do not get frozen in a book page.
Right.
It's a very limited sensory experience. It enhances things, but it's specialist. It's single. And your imagination, what people like about reading is the interior landscape compensates with the imaginary fill-ins of the sensory ratios, right?
Mm-hmm.
Of the other senses.
Mm-hmm.
So anyways, we're talking about, why do we get onto this?
So the central nervous system gets numbed.
So the tactile
by tactility. Is it possible
get this, Scott. The tactile is not a sense. It's the interplay of senses. We extend the interplay of the senses. So what's the past environment? All the senses. And they all go loud.
Yeah.
Just think of the standard images of the last 30 years. Loud music, loud billboards, loud racing cars,
right.
Hyperkinetic speed, you know, just the whole panoply.
Because the central nervous system, which is the internal senses, are getting numb, so the external senses get loud.
Yeah, not the internal senses, the interplay of senses.
So is there any solution to the numbing of the central nervous system? So that we just resign ourselves to living under this, you know?
Well, McLuhan said the book was the answer.
Oh.
But the book had to be a multi-sensory book like Joyce, like Penning is Awake, the way Ben and I talk about it. You use it in a group and talk
at
the human scale and discuss the book.
Right.
And it's the only kind of book you can have endless discussion around.
You might be able to massage the central nervous system so as to get it unnumbed.
Yeah, by taking a very limited situation, a book, but the book contains all experience. So you get both. You get your limited. You calm down. You get static. You get static visual space, but it's not limited to the definitions of book and includes all the other media experiences. And then you use language, a tactile medium. You recover language and talk about it.
Well, it includes all of the other...
Finnegan's Wake or speech?
Finnegan's Wake.
Yeah.
That's what we're talking about.
Yeah.
It includes all the other senses within the visual sense.
Within the limited medium of print.
Limited medium of the visual space.
Yeah.
See, the book fragmented the visual space out from the sensory matrix.
Yeah.
Now, Finnegan's Wake can't really what it can do is it can integrate the other senses into the visual, but it can't put the visual back into the other senses.
It's an ersatz environment. It's a private artifact. The only way to get poise in the 60s, 70s was to be turn off the environment. That's the only way.
Mm-hmm.
And we didn't, so everybody went mad.
Well, is reading Finnegan's Wake like turning off the environment?
For you personally, it's a private way of massaging yourself into slack.
Yeah.
You take, and you do it in an, you return to human scale because you do it in a group and you discuss it. So you retrieve community.
Well, you do. You that's potentially, is that what's happening in Jerry's group?
Well, yeah, I think the people go there for a sense of community.
Yeah, I think you're right.
But they probably, I don't know. It's good. I mean, the Wake, because it invites everything and all interpretations, includes everybody, so it's quite democratic. So it's the best book to continually explore.
I'll tell you the one way in which it's not democratic, and that is that I have trouble with the written word, and so that book is very difficult for me to read, and therefore it's a bit embarrassing to be in a group of people.
Okay,
some of whom have really good chops.
Yeah. But that those good chops are irrelevant. That's the real democratic part. It is for dyslexics and people who can't read. Because you can't, if you read it properly, you can't read it. And therefore you sound like someone who can't read. That's another joke that Joyce put in.
Hmm.
So you shouldn't feel inferior. There's someone who can read over it real fast because they've read it many times, and I can do that. You're missing a lot of the meanings. It's meant to be read slowly and haltingly.
Mm-hmm.
You can do the speedy thing, but that's not better. That's just another way of looking at the mud. So if you got an inferiority complex about it, then it's all Finney's Wake heals you because it gives you a welcoming environment where it's okay to stumble.
Yeah.
And tell that to anybody who reads it well. Hey, you're missing a lot by reading it well.
Mm.
That's just a literate response. So it's very democratic, includes you.
Mm-hmm.
And that's pretty remarkable, pretty funny way to do a book.
Well, now, how does it include the kinetic sensibility?
Because of you might read it fast and get the kinetic rhythms.
Mm. Right, it has a kinetic in the same way that music has kinetic.
Yeah, and it shows kinetic the it describes the sensations you get walking around.
Yeah, it has the fits and starts and
And the running
flows, running. Yeah,
yeah. So
see, now that's starting to sound like what McKenna, when he did the Time Wave Zero, based on his meditations on the I Ching combined with his mushroom channeling, concluded that what the key I Ching is showing us was that there's 64 qualities to time.
Yeah.
And so we're just talking about Finnegan's Wake, fits and starts, running, flowing, a stream of consciousness. These are different qualities of time. So maybe maybe that's one of the reasons why Terrence sniffed out Finnegan's Wake, because he could feel the resonance.
Yeah, well, anybody should be able to sniff out Finney's Wake because it includes you and everybody else. Now, most people don't know that, but he saw the drugs in there, and he emphasized that univocal level, which is limited. It's there, but he specialized in that interpretation, celebrated for that.
Well, yeah, but I'm not specifically referring, don't mean to hyphenate the drugs, but to hyphenate the idea that that there are these qualities of time. The time yep. itself has, you know, may, possibly period, is composed of
periodicities. The periodicity of time.
Yeah, but 64 qualities matches 64 different qualities of time. All
yeah, that's periods. Different periods of time. It's the periodic cycle.
Yeah. So one quality might be this, where you get the fits and starts in the wake, where it's kind of jerky. You know, and then there's other parts where it's rushing, it just wants to go fast, and other parts where it wants to meander and go more slowly or easily. These would be different qualities of time.
Yeah, and that's included in the content. The great anti-environment of wake is it freezes it all. It takes the value of the book, the service of the book, retrieves the validity of the book in relation to the chaos around us. It freezes, brings order to it. But you have to figure out how to see that.
Yeah, what kind of order? You might have to redefine order. What do you think order is?
It lets the eyes be seen. It freezes your eyes. In other words, no books hold any attention. People read them, throw them away. Read another one, throw them away. This one, you can't fucking read, so you stop, if you're going to get into it, and you try to read it, and then you get involved in it. And all the time, you're staring at the book. So it's that line from page 52, the television kills, telephone brothers boils. The eyes demand their turn. Let them be seen. Joyce figured out how to retrieve the eyes so that their function could be participating.
Well, maybe he meant E-Y-E-S and capital I, eyes.
Oh, yeah.
Because if this sounds like, from, you know, the way you're describing fixing the eyes, staring, and then, you know, beginning to hallucinate on the words, is that it's moving you into your imagination, which may be closer to the eye that you are. And when you, if you could actually use the book to then completely detach from the book and go into your own, the novelty of your own imagination, apart from having any structure which is acting as a guide. But the Finnegan's Wake would be like the last you know, the thing that would guide you in, you know, all the way into your own imagination.
Well, that's what the book does. So it gives you a book that you can imagine it with. Mm-hmm. So it exercises your imagination muscle. That's not a big deal, but it's something people can do.
Now, I do find the density of the details and the metaphor and the puns and the metaphors and so on to be a bit, it's hard for me to relax and allow. I start getting a little uptight, like, oh, there's too much going on here. I'll never sort this out.
Okay, well, that's the yoga of the book. Joyce takes what should be a limiting experience, reading, and then puts in the contrary evocation of chaos or multiple stuff so that you learn how to handle it. So it's like taking a drug, as McLuhan said, it's more useful than taking drugs. Equal experience, but safer. So it trains you, not only does it freeze your eye, it trains you to handle other levels of multi-level experience. So if you find that hard, then that's what it's there for you to exercise that limitation in you. He's got it all covered, everything. You know what I mean? If you find it too much, then it helps you train yourself to appreciate too much.
Yeah.
All the time being saved by this frozen thing. So, you know, people walk around and they don't know what to look at. They're just taking in all the data. Well, how do you retrieve the eye looking at something? You create a book like The Wake so your eye can look at something.
Mm-hmm.
You're just walk around in a scanning mode normally, and you're distracted by all kinds of things. You don't focus. You can't focus your eye on one thing.
Right. It's that focusing of the attention.
Yeah.
Which, you know, that's a Sufi thing. The focusing of the attention evokes the, you know, it awakens or revives the sleeping machine. Brings it back into
the
present.
The eye.
Yeah.
The eye has been disappeared by tactility. So the eye demands to be seen. You're reading a book is actually like engaging and creating an eye temporarily.
Mm-hmm.
Reading Finney's Wake.
Mm.
The eye is seen.
Well, now, do other books have this effect to a lesser degree?
Well, people read books. That's why there's all senses had a renaissance. They all were enhanced under the 20th century. So people read more books than ever.
Yeah.
That's why McLuhan said books were obsolete. You're going to read more and more, but they don't have any real formation in the society, but they're an anesthetic old sense that is desperately needed, desperately massaged by people. They read, they watch movies, they just rotate among all the sensory extensions. So, but that does not give you a poise in understanding.
No, because you fall asleep in the trance of all your media activities.
Yeah, most people fall asleep reading their books. You know, they read them late at night and go to sleep to them.
Yeah.
You can't do that with awake.
Well, yeah. And, you know, and people just sort of half-zombied going through life.
Yeah, McCormick.
Anesthetized by, well, central nervous system anesthetized, and then, you know, using other medias, other forms of media as compensation for the fact that your central nervous system has been anesthetized.
The anesthetics are all the different media. All the different senses in broke spirals of loudness are the anesthetics today.
Well, the core anesthetic is the numbing of the tactile function.
Yeah. Okay.
So then the other senses become compensatory ways of trying to fill in that numbness.
Right, but you're forced to do that because you've been numbed by the tactility, so it creates all that other reaction of running around trying to retrieve your senses.
Right. So, reading Finnegan's Wake, you can massage yourself out of that numbness to some degree, or provide some.
No, you just retrieve the eye.
But then the central nervous system is still numb. The tactile function is still numb. What are we going to do about the fact that the tactile function has been numbed?
Well, I say cold fusion gets us out of that, but we haven't got there yet, so everybody's numb.
Mm. So that's just the condition. You don't seem to mind it.
Well, what am I going to do? Like, do I mind the weather? No. Do I mind? There are millions of humans coming and going.
If your central nervous system is numb, that would imply that you're suffering to some degree because you're not alive.
That never bothered humans.
Well, it doesn't bother. But how did you get alive under these conditions?
I don't know.
Is your central nervous system numbed, Bob?
I don't think so. You know, as Nelson used to say, Bob, ever since he's 5 years old, he's been wiping his windshield of his senses every day, cleaning them, keeping them pristine, pure, and sharp.
Yeah.
That's what I've been doing.
Well, I had this thought listening to Bob and Ben 29, I guess it was, is that Ben is trying to, what Ben wants more than anything else is what Ion proposes to offer, although Ben won't get it through the Ion medium.
Right.
But what he's looking for is to get out of the hypnosis of time.
Yeah.
That's what Ben is doing, and I don't think he knows that's what he's doing. You guys start surfing into a particular frequency, and he gets to taste, you know, that momentary transcending relinquishing the stuck illusion of time.
Yeah.
That feels good, and so he becomes a junkie for that. But I don't think he knows that's what it is. And this is central to what Ion is talking about is snapping out of that.
Yeah.
But I don't know if anybody's done it. It sounds like he's still trying to get you to figure that one out.
Ion.
Yeah.
Ion is always trying to get us to get more. So I've gotten a lot of stuff from him. There's more to get. So, and he's there.
But I mean, in terms of actually recognizing that there is no time, it appears.
I've been complimented by Ion.
You've been complimented?
Yeah, Carol and I've been complimented how much we've learned or taken in or taken out from Ion since March.
Right. Relative to all the other monkeys on this planet, you're probably...
Right, because as Ion says, you have a great advantage, Bob. You have access to non-physical, you know, 24/7. Nobody has that, so, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're getting a special course.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it was so I did you know that I got the part two of the dream thing?
Okay, yeah. I think you sent that to Carol and she forwarded it to me.
Yeah.
But before, let me go back to this Ben thing is interesting. You notice Ben, he's now even bringing up my chart.
Is he starting to use the five-body terminology a little bit?
Yeah, well, he did that in show 28 and 29, didn't he?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, he did.
He begrudgingly let the words, like, you know, chip body or something like that slip through his lips.
Well, we went and looked at the chart, didn't we? I showed it to him before we did it or during it. We looked at it before the session, before recording. He wanted to look at it.
Oh, wow. Well, God, he's taking an interest. He recognizes that this Bob guy knows something. Maybe I ought to take a look at his shit.
That's right. Well, I sent you his email, eh? Thank you for getting me into the electric ether. Remember he said that? I forwarded it to him.
Oh, yeah, I know. That's cool. And I hope he intellectual prowess, if he were to dive into that chart, you know, take an interest in the four main characters and begin to discuss the chart, you know, with you, that would be really cool. But we all know that Ben...
And he's the punchline of the chart.
Have you pointed that out to him yet? Has he heard that?
Yeah. Ben is dead?
Yeah.
No, that's what we did. Before last week or the week before, we went to the chart, and then I scanned him down and got him to see it.
Yeah. And then, but that's in the Bob quadrant, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Dobbs is going to nail Ben. It's all predicted what will happen to Ben.
I know. Ben
is going to get out of this alive.
Yeah, I know.
So that was good. So what did you think of the Eben show with Ion?
Oh, I haven't got to hear it yet.
Holy shit, Scott.
We had the Thanksgiving thing going on, and so didn't have time.
Well, you should listen to it right now and then call me in 2 hours or something, because Ion spills his guts.
Wow.
Big trouble now.
Why? He said shit that...
Yeah, we shouldn't have done.
Oh, no.
You'll hear it.
Hmm. Yeah.
Well, I don't know if we should have, but, you know, it's risky, maybe.
Yeah. what evoked it? Was it a question from the audience or from...
Well, Ion complimented after Eben's good interviewer. You know, she was pretty good question, asked good questions.
Has she, like, been doing her homework and hearing, like, the cash flow show in order to get a better idea of Ion?
I told her to listen to the Curtis Davis show.
Yeah,
and she didn't get a chance to listen to it, and so she never does her homework. But
I actually wasn't that impressed with that show, other than that was interesting. He talked about that way of getting out of paying taxes if you're...
Yeah, the TIN number.
Yeah.
JW said to me after, he'd never even heard of it.
Hmm.
No, yeah, there was some good stuff in there, but that was especially good, and that's the kind of stuff Evan would be interested in, so...
Yeah, and it would help her to know what to ask.
Yeah. So what happened? So after the show, Eben got on the line and Ion was still on, so she got another hour with Ion and got told even more amazing stuff.
All right.
I taped that, so we have that. So, you should got to hear that Eben show. And then, again, the Wednesday show was always entertaining. It's always great fun, and Buzz makes great YouTubes from it.
Yeah, I like the Wednesday show. It's very good.
And have you heard, checked out Buzz's, he makes YouTube pretty quickly.
Yeah, I don't have too much time to spend with the YouTubes.
Yeah.
I mean,
just hear what he does. I don't catch all the pictures, don't have time, but I scan them or just glance at them while I'm doing the dishes. But yeah. I listen to what he's done, and he makes some funny excerpts.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so then the next thing, okay, so you didn't hear that. Okay, so did you listen to the new death thing?
Yeah, I did. And it's fun, you know, there's multi- multiple levels in which it's fun to hear.
Yeah.
I didn't get all my... there were questions hanging over from the tape number one that I had left over after tape number two, but nevertheless, there were other stuff in there that was holding my interest, like your banter with him over the sacred geometry stuff.
The Dan Winter, the first 40 minutes.
Yeah.
It was pretty interesting, isn't it?
It was funny as hell the way that he... He kept trying to put an end to the whole thing, and you kept persisting and reading the stuff, which he couldn't. And then at one point he fell into hysterics.
Yes.
When you talked about the cunning Kunalini or Cunnilingus. Cunnilingus.
Yeah, no, Kluve stuff.
And then he fell into hysterics, and when he laughs, it's hard not to laugh.
Would you say he tried not to laugh?
No, I'm saying it's hard not to laugh when you hear Ion going full laughter.
I think it was like he said, "My God, we got 23 false premises and piling up more, another 10 false premises on top of 23 of them."
Right.
It was just Ion's just amazed at human creativity.
Yeah. Well, also one thing that I got from that number two session was he talked about the made a distinction about the thinker and the thunk.
Yeah.
And that's when I was listening to Ben and Bob 29, I was thinking, yeah, that's where Ben is stuck in being the thinker part.
he doesn't know he's being thunk.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the literate Gutenberg voice, his inner voice. He's really trapped in. That's what he likes about Finney's Wake. He can mutate his inner voice.
Yeah.
His thinking.
Yeah. Well, it's I can relate because I'm stuck inside my inner voice most of the time, and it's kind of
well, Ben uses the wake to get out of his thinking voice, but
right.
he only sees the wake for that, to massage his thinking and break up his routine thinking.
The thinking voice must have something to do with the generation of the perception of time.
Yeah.
So, it becomes like a Chinese, trying to really get what Ion is saying about that there is no time. Well, if you think about it, that doesn't help, because that's like putting your finger in one of those Chinese finger traps. The more you try to pull your fingers out, the tighter the trap grips your fingers.
Yeah, there is, though, and that's because I've done a lot with Ion, there is some thinking about it that works, but I don't know how.
You start thinking along with him, and he sets up a crevice for you to sort of fall into and pops you out of thinking.
Yeah. Or it makes you get out of your limited thinking and you think on another level.
Yeah. Exactly.
So that was okay, the second one.
Yeah, a lot of what he was doing was, what we were just talking about, trying to sort of trick you out of thinking, trick you out of thinking so that you get a sense of this eternity that he's talking about.
Yeah.
I didn't get clear, I guess, did you cover in that tape the process of choosing to go into the guff and have the residues, etheric residues, resolved back into the plane of nothingness or whatever?
I don't know. I don't know what you're talking about.
In tape one, you very carefully distinguished the stages where first you experience your feeling being cut in half, cut in half, cut in half, and then you find yourself floating. The body is still maybe barely alive, but you're floating over it, and you're seeing, watching what's going on. And then you're pronounced. I don't know exactly what his big deal is about. You have to be pronounced dead in order to be dead. I mean, people's bodies die when there's nobody around to pronounce it, but nevertheless, you're pronounced dead, and then you're. But then you don't go right. You go right to the guff, but there's no time, so you can't.
No, you don't go to the guff. You don't go to the guff.
Right, because you're stuck in the fact that there's no time to get there or something.
Yeah. You got all eternity to get there. Now, what happens next is in three, the third one. Like what you've got, I can't remember what I haven't listened to number two again, but I guess.
Well, okay, let me just finish complete that thought. So you find yourself it's half by half by half, and then you break free of the body, and now you're in this sort of, you're in the ethers.
Yeah,
but he doesn't distinguish between the guff because of that, because the ethers are in the guff too. But anyway, you're in the ethers and your residue is hanging around. And then there's this, at some point after you've completed whatever your residue is hanging around, that eventually gets completed. You make the choice to go back to the guff. But I don't think he talked about releasing the residues.
Right, and that is in part three. I'm speaking to you from knowing part three.
Oh.
And part three clarifies the process before you go to the guff.
Oh.
And it's only, I think it's only it's a 2 or 3 hour tape, but there's a big preamble with Carolyn and something after. It's only about an hour, I think, maybe approximately.
Mm.
Not as long as, and I charge you for 2 hours, but you only got, the second was only an hour and a half, so I owe you $7, so I probably only charge you $7 for the third one. For an hour, it'll be an hour thing, but I only charge you for half an hour.
Oh, in that case, I'll just go ahead and order it like tonight, because now I want to hear it.
Yeah, give me. I might need a few days to edit it. I have not edited it yet, so I haven't listened to it. But Carolyn's just going through it. She told me, so I know I can speed it up.
Okay.
Yeah, so you can put in an order, but give me a few days to get it to you.
No hurry, because I need to listen to number two
a couple more
times.
You need to listen to all three.
Yeah,
you need to hear the thing, and there may even be more, but we didn't do any more yet.
Right.
But, yeah, there's a whole interesting thing that's surprising in part three.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, listen to part two, though, again, and get it clear. The residue. See, there's the ghosts are your residue, and you have nothing to do with that. That's what people still here see or experience, the residue of you.
Yeah. Right, because they already created you as part of their universe anyway, so they can continue to reinvoke you for their purposes, I guess.
Yeah, they can pick up your tapes.
Yeah, but that doesn't necessarily mean that you're stuck until they're done with your tapes.
Right.
Because you're not in the tapes, or are you?
Right, but you can be. Does he get into that point where you can stay around?
Yeah. Like, for instance, you said, he used the example you and Carolyn and using the screwdriver, teaching each other, you don't know how to use a screwdriver, but she does, so she hangs around to help you out or whatever. And you have the power to hold her because you're the creator at that point. She's no longer being the creator.
Did you hear the part where I've held McLuhan and Zappa back?
McLuhan, I don't hear Zappa part.
Oh, yeah, but McLuhan.
Yeah.
McLuhan. I kept bringing him back.
Yeah, but, he was unclear about that, because then you said, you mean I've been holding all these people back? I've been talking through the Evergreens? He goes, no, Bob, let's not. You're making too much out. No, just McLuhan, Bob. So
there's some really funny things in those conversations, aren't there?
Yeah, a lot of it. One of the things relaxing and allowing myself to enjoy Ion is that some of it I just enjoy his words and the, you know, the, you can, I can feel that there's somebody substantial behind those words.
Yeah.
And to let that massage me, even when he's doing science stuff that sounds like he's just making up poetry or something, it doesn't sound like real science at all.
You know, there's as you get used to it, get to know more, it makes more sense. Like when I re-listen to the first sessions as I inventory them, it's amazing. I don't have any clue what he's talking about, but now I know, and I listen to it, and he's very clear to me. But I know I didn't know what he was talking about back at the beginning.
Yeah, and I, you know, like when I heard cash flow, he dropped a few words and phrases that now have meaning for me only after having heard, you know, six, 5 or 6 hours of Ion, or more, however many hours I've heard of him. So things I know that somebody who's tuning in for the first time aren't going to get necessarily all the...
That's the whole problem. If you don't want to learn, you're not going to get it.
Well, yeah, but also there's a cumulative effect of hearing him make references and then embroider those references into a future talk, and you go, oh, yeah, I see the implication, more of the implications based on the fact that you're referring to something he referred to in a previous talk, and he referred to in a previous talk before that, and now it's starting to make connections between the synapses in my brain.
Yeah. That's where it's exercise. If you don't wait around, if you're not patient, you're just going to think Ion's garble because you don't learn it.
Yeah.
You don't exercise it.
Yeah. And it also, you know, it can have to do with the mood. One day I listened to it and I was thoroughly absorbed and fascinated, and then I listened to it in a bad mood a couple days later, and I, what the fuck is this guy talking about anyway?
No, that's true. Yeah, and you have to be smart enough to say, well, I'm not going to be fooled by my judgment today.
Right. Yeah.
Which most people aren't. I don't want to hear that again. It's crap. You know, they don't know they're going to change.
Right. And, you know, I mean, Gurdjieff addressed that, and I think Lily did too, creating, and EJ, creating some kind of a thread of consistency that runs through all those different selves.
Yeah, like remembering.
Self-remembering, yeah.
Ion talks about trying to get us to remember.
Yeah, I know, because we know everything he knows, and the only reason we don't know that we know that is because we don't allow ourselves to remember.
That's what's really good about Ion. He sums up the whole counterculture, mystical, all the different groups. It's all crystallized, and he does it all.
Yeah. I'd still like to hear him more specifically on Haramine, because I can't believe Haramine and Winters are working together, because Winters is a crank.
Sort of, but he's pretty good at the spirals and geometry.
Yeah, he does those great visualizations, but the myths that he's overlaid onto all of that stuff.
Yeah, he's probably, that's probably why the professors work with him. Ridiculous.
Yeah.
He brings in Sitchin stuff and claims that we're the angels of this or that. It's just stupid. But he's an interesting quadrophenic. I mean, if you know it's all bullshit, then I like him more than Steam, because he's more multi-level and nuttier.
Yeah. Yeah. He is. He is.
I mean, you have to learn his language. Once you get it, you can follow it.
Right.
And then you just see it's easy, and I agree with Ion about, you know, you
well, what I, you know, what I got from what I think I understood from Ion's ragging on the Dan Winters material is that if you get too deep into the Dan Winter trip, you're going to end up living in a false imagination of the universe that you're creating in your, you know, in your thoughts, and you're not going to directly experience the power of the Trinity when it's all working together.
Yeah, what's great, it's either in the first one or the second one, we're talking about Winter, and he starts off by saying, well, Winter's talking about what's the same. He's emphasizing what is the same. He's trying to find out what is the same. Mm-hmm. And just that point, That's McLuhan's. They're just visually matching. And that's all he's doing. He's trying to say this one dodecahedron spiral is everywhere.
Yeah.
And that's ridiculous. You're limiting yourself to think everything's the same.
Yeah, he's...
It's a big mistake right out of the chute.
Yeah, yeah. He's obviously a visually biased guy.
Yeah.
I'm more acoustic biased, but I like the Haramine stuff because he taught me how to visualize the geometric forms because he put them in a context that made me in a mystery. I wanted to keep finding out more and more and more about it. So I learned to start visualizing a little bit, which is good for me because I think I'm a pretty ear-oriented person for the most part.
So what were we talking about? You're talking about seeing Nassim's YouTubes, or you bought the course?
No, at the New Renaissance Bookstore, I could rent his videos.
DVDs. Did that?
Yeah.
Now, don't they end up with the same geometry as Winter? You know, the dodecahedron stuff?
No, his conclusions are more coherent and can be described in terms of actual, you know, consensus reality physics, it's just much more. This whole thing is actually grounded, I think.
Yeah, more slower grounded. It doesn't have information overload.
Yeah, but it no, but it overload. It. It has an incredible beauty and elegance to it, and I think he may understand actually what we need to understand to get to the cold fusion, the extraterrestrial travel, and all this kind of stuff. I think he's understanding the real physics behind that stuff. He's the first guy that I've heard that's impressed me as having something solid.
Yeah. Now, does he talk about time?
Yeah. As a matter of fact, he got all embroidered in the challenge of discovering the model of physics that he's working with, because as a child, in his first he was really excited in his first geometry class, and when the teacher put a point on the chalkboard and said, "Well, this point actually doesn't exist because there's no dimensionality." And then he put another point and he made a line. And he said, "Then this line actually doesn't exist because there's no dimensionality in which this line could exist." And he puts, a couple more points on and drives, creates a plane and says that the plane doesn't exist. But then, if you put these four more points in and you extend it into space so that it now has volume, now it exists. So you take something which is like a plane, which doesn't exist, and you square that plane, you square non-existence, and now all of a sudden you come up with something that exists. What Haramine discovered was that the point can be, there's a, that within the point, he discovered what, just to jump ahead a little bit, is the structure of the vacuum, and that it's it's divisible infinite number of times, and that it's ridiculous to think that there's some end point to the process of division. So what you have is you can divide the structure of the vacuum, and the tinier the divisions, the more potent the actual energy of the vacuum is. So, and you get down to a small enough point, the potency of the vacuum is such that it penetrates into the singularity of the black hole, and then it sucks energy into itself, which it's also radiating back out. And there's an equilibrium between the event horizon, which would be the sphere surrounding the black hole, the radiant sphere surrounding the black hole. There's a equilibrium between that pushing out and the black hole, the singularity at the tiny, tiny, unimaginably small singularity, a powerful singularity at the center, which is pulling in. And
what's the last few words?
It's pulling in. It's actually generating gravitational pull towards its center. It's trying to pull the sphere back into itself. But as it does so, it's pulling that energy into itself, which then ends up radiating back out in equilibrium. So you have an equilibrium between the singularity and the event horizon, or the sphere surrounding the singularity. And the sphere surrounding the singularity is falling in on itself like a smoke ring. It's the shape of a torus, and there are he's allowing for black holes of various sizes, not just the black holes that Hawking has discovered, with where you have the implosion of an entire star, or what they think was the implosion of a star, into such a small, tiny bit of space down at the Planck's, or below the Planck's level of tininess, like 10 to the minus 64 centimeters. Where all the mass of that star gets sucked into the black hole. there are images of stars which have collapsed into the black hole configuration, and where they're pulling energy in towards the center, there's energy shooting out at the top and the bottom, and it creates a cycle of energy, so that the energy is like shooting out from the top and the bottom out, and then arcing back on itself in this sphere, which is being pulled back in towards the center, which is shooting energy back out, squirting energy back out and pulling it back in. And Harmine says that, like, for instance, in physics, you have the weak force and the strong force at the subatomic level, and the strong force is holding the nucleus together. It's holding the protons and the neutrons together, and it's supposedly composed of these things called gluons, and they postulate that force must be there, because there's no way that these protons and neutrons could be held together that close, since they repel each other with tremendous power. What's pulling them together and holding them together as a group? And they say, well, there's this thing called a strong force. They just postulate that it must be there, and that it's made up of these things called gluons, and that underneath the gluons there's even a stronger force that is pulling on these gluons, which is pulling the nucleus together. But they just call it all the strong force, the force of the gluons and the force that's pulling the protons and neutrons together. They call it the strong force, and then they don't know what it is. Well, Harmine showed that if you can allow for to put infinity back into your equations, the fact that space, the vacuum of space, is infinitely divisible, and it doesn't, there's no limit to it, which science puts a limit on. You say Planck's constant is the smallest you can get, and below that all the laws of physics break down and we don't know what happens, and we fall into a singularity, and we're basing all of our physics of the universe on the fact that we don't know what happens when the laws of physics break down. And Harmine says, no, there's, you've got there's actually a black hole at the center of the atom. It's just that it's so fucking tiny relative to a black hole that you would see, you know, looking out astronomically with your telescope across vast distances of space where entire stars have apparently collapsed into a massive black hole. Now you've got a black hole that's so fucking small, it's actually, and the force of its attraction, the force of the energy being pulled into its singularity, is actually strong enough to hold the protons and neutrons together in the atom. They've worked out the mathematics. A black hole of that size would have a certain amount of attractive force, and it would be enough to overcome the force of the protons and neutrons repelling each other. And he's also discovered, I believe, there's a black hole at the center of our sun. The energy is being sucked into this black hole and under tremendous pressure and under tremendous force that a black hole can generate of a particular magnitude or size. Black hole at the center of the sun would be a little bit bigger than a black hole at the center of an atom, but it would be dealing with larger forces. And so what you see on the surface of the sun actually is the event horizon. And there are certain Coriolis effects associated with black holes. Like, for instance, the Coriolis effect is what you see when you see, like, a tornado. It's the way that the thing twists towards the center, according to the Fibonacci series, which I know Ion in the dream tape number 2 seemed to think that was he glossed over this idea that the Fibonacci series is not true, which is a ridiculous statement. It's true. It's just a fucking measurement, and it can be measured and observed in many places within nature. But so you get this Coriolis effect with the way that the black hole is drawing energy. It's creating a sphere of energy. It's ejecting energy through the top and bottom, creating this sphere. But it's also drawing it back into itself. It's circulating it, and it does so. It has these Coriolis effects, and the Coriolis effects match up perfectly with certain astronomical observations, like, for instance, where you see sunspots. Those are actually vortexes. Scientists or astrophysicists are just beginning to figure that out. They thought that they were with some kind of an ejection, or I don't know what they thought it was. They thought it was on the surface of the sun, a sunspot is actually a vortex. It goes all the way back down. It's certain places where the black hole at the center is creating this Coriolis effect, and where you have a sunspot on one side of the sun, you'll look and you'll see there's one directly on the other side, because the Coriolis effect is such that it creates a twister above and a twister below. There's two twisters going towards the center, but one's twisting in one direction relative to the surface of the sphere, and the other's going the other direction relative to the surface of the sphere, which is like we see water and toilets go clockwise in the northern hemisphere and counterclockwise in the southern hemisphere. Well, these sunspots align perfectly with the Coriolis, where you would anticipate the Coriolis effect from the way that the black hole is drawing, is virtually just sucking huge amounts of energy back into itself while at the same time radiating the energy back out. And you get this toroidal movement, which is like a smoke ring or a donut that just keeps falling through itself in the middle. Yeah. So the spot on the Jupiter on Jupiter falls perfectly in line with where you would expect to find the Coriolis effect from the black hole at its center. There's a black hole at the center of our Earth, and it's and the black hole and black hole spin, which is interesting because, like, Harmine points out that, like, he does this experiment. He takes two eggs. One egg is hard-boiled, and the other one is, you know, not. So it's got the yolk and the white stuff, goop in it. He takes the hard-boiled egg and spins it on the ground, and it just spins and spins and spins. He takes the egg with the goop in it, the yellow, you know, goopy middle, spins it, and the thing wobbles and barely can make a complete rotation. And then he points out the fact that physics bases the idea that all of the atoms spin and the Earth spins and the Sun spins because there's no friction in space. And so that these things, there's nothing to slow them down, so they just spin forever. But the fact is, the center of the Earth is like the center of an egg relative to its skin, relative to the hardness of the surface of the Earth, which is cooled down. Down in the center, you have molten lava, and you have the Earth spinning, and there are lots of different friction points within the Earth that would create the same kind of problem you have with the egg. So there are forces within the Earth, because of the different densities of the layers, that would cause in a kind of an internal inertia which should slow the spin of the Earth down. The same thing with the Sun, these massive gases. But what keeps them fucking turning is the fucking black hole at the center, which is creating these Coriolis effects, is drawing these vortexes into itself and creating a dynamo. The fucking thing spins, and it spins, you know, the planets, it spins your electrons around your atoms, it spins your Sun, and so on. And but in order to really appreciate what I'm saying, you have to see his fucking presentation, because he takes you step by step through the process of realizing when he was in taking his first geometry class that something was really wrong. You know, that there, you know, he hit on this idea that, you know, a point could be divided infinitely, so why were they telling him, you know, that this wasn't true? Starting from that basic premise, and then gradually working through various stages of working with the tetrahedron in work in various geometrical stages of evolution. And then when you get the whole thing, it's just, it's stunningly beautiful. His excitement and his enthusiasm, if you're the only man alive, then he's, you know, not far behind, because this guy is, he's electric, man. I mean, he's tapped into something real, in my opinion. And that's where he gets his energy from. So, and whereas, you know, Dan Winters is a labyrinth of fascination and imagination, and there's elegance in his geometry, and so, you know, he's a fascinating guy, but the whole Sitchin thing and all that it's really creepy. It just, I don't think it leads to an enlightened mind.
Yeah, you go along and then you say, so therefore, if you have mucus, your soul is dead.
Yeah.
Okay, this whole involuted torus goes out and in. Dan does use that.
Right. Oh, I know. It's part of the, you know, and the Drunvalo. See, the first place I read about it was Drunvalo, who I think I think Drunvalo is a little more credible than Dan Winter. But not maybe not as much of a genius, but a genius, in, but maybe a little. What he's doing is reflecting reality a little more, and you know, he Drenvalo shows, you know, how the Taurus represents fields around bio, you know, our biological systems, which Dan Winter likes to do also. And it's part of the flower of life thing, and it's something that has been part of esoteric traditions probably for a long time. I mean, the master who spoke to Dr. Case, who, you know, is Mark's thing, the BOTA, this knowledge has probably been around in various forms. It forms the basis of the whole Merkaba thing idea. Biological fields, which are these various toruses, which interact and interplay, and so on. He didn't come at it through esoteric stuff. He didn't get it through channeling. He didn't get it through, reading John Dee or anything like that. He just was curious about this conundrum in physics. He couldn't understand how come they refused to admit the idea of infinity into their equations. And it's because the mind is limited. The mind has a hard time thinking about infinity. The mind has a hard time of being outside of time. It wants to create time. And
that's the rule. See, that's where Ion's labyrinth is really useful. Trinity is really useful. You got the physical and the non-physical. They're givens, and you have the mind in between, can't take in the whole thing, so it makes rules and regulations about it.
Yeah.
And part of humanity doesn't want to. Well, part of maybe the relationship, in other words, you have the infinite and non-physical, but you also want the limited, or you couldn't be here. So you want to come here and mix it up and have contrast. So you got to have the limited, and the mind negotiates that. It keeps you in the physical, so to speak.
You know, it sounds to me like...
And that's a natural, that's a natural process. And you never can change your rules, but you can add to them.
Well, if you make dumb rules, you can't change them?
It was interesting. I was talking about this the other day. You can't change the rules you have, but you can, like, soften them up or add these others. Something like that.
Mm.
Which is interesting, you know, because everybody tries to get rid of their mind. And that's futile.
Yeah.
And that's a new angle. You don't hear anything being said about that.
Well, you know, another thing that Ion's... You may be able to get rid of your mind, but I don't... Only a few people have ever done it. Because one of the things, you know, Ion, you know, relax and allow, sounds a lot like what... what was the Krishnamurti guy, the other Krishnamurti?
Yeah, Uga.
Yuji Krishnamurti. I mean, that's what he was saying. He was saying, people are thinking too much. The intelligence intrinsic within the biology of this body knows what it's doing. All I have to, you know, I just, I'm living that. I'm not separating from it.
Yeah, but now, Ion basically says, get these three things balanced. Use them all. And therefore you wouldn't take a position on it.
So it sounds to me like the place that everybody really wants to be, both non-physical and physical, is in the gap.
Yeah.
Between the two.
Yeah, here. Here and in the gap.
Well, here, but like in my case, I need to bring non-physical in more.
Yeah.
Because I'm kind of lost. I'm lost in time.
You don't get rid of your non-physical. It's there. You just have rules that doesn't image it as part of yourself.
Yeah.
And so you got to figure out how to add some rules that gives you the images of how it's part of you.
Well, yeah, images of no time and, I mean, literally, if you had no time, I don't think you'd have space either.
Oh, yeah, there's no space.
So...
We get to that.
So the Buddhists, when they talk about the clear light of the void, that's about as close as you can get to talking about it, a non-physical, except that it makes it seem like an impersonal nothing, and you go talk to non-physical, and you go, well, it's fucking alive.
That's right, and it's here. You see, the void, you don't... That's what Barry Nevitt in his book said. The East goes into the void too much, and the West goes into the individual figure too much.
Yeah.
You've got to have both go together.
Right. McLuhan knew that.
What?
McLuhan knew that. And maybe that is tactility.
Yeah, that's tactility, but it has to have three parts. That's the revolution here.
Yeah.
The role of... No one knows what to do with the mind. They try to get rid of it or overuse it. They love it. They hate it. But if you include the non-physical, so you got to have that intuition that there is non-physical. You have to find and kind of prove it to yourself that there is.
Yeah.
Then you know that's there, and you know, I'm going to die, and I'll feel bliss, and I'll say, damn, I didn't have to come back here to feel the bliss. I know it's here. I could have stayed in the physical and known. You know, that's the trick, to stay in the physical and really know and believe the bliss of the non-physical. And so then you have that, and then you have your physical, which is your ability to create. And you use your mind to create things, or you go beyond your mind to create things, but you're here to mix it up and celebrate the contrast. Because Ion even implies, if you have constant resistanceless bliss, like when you're dead, it gets bland and boring. You don't know you have it.
Yeah.
You have to come here to get the contrast, and here you can have both. And you can enjoy the contrast, or know the contrast is there to help you get the bliss, or to know you have the bliss.
Yeah.
So...
Well, there must be worlds where people are already living and already know this, as opposed to this world you and I inhabit.
People
where
on the Earth who know that.
On our Earth.
Yeah, like Saint Germain has been around for thousands of years or something. As a matter of fact, he can't determine it. He's in that zone where it's...
Well, I wonder if he gets bored, because the whole physical thing gets boring after a while, too.
Yeah, that's why you juggle through the three, then
yeah.
you create some rules for yourself and take the problems that brings. It's like my juggling the bodies,
right?
And it's an ongoing thing. If you know there's more coming, then you there'll always be new things to do with it.
Yeah,
new problems, new releases, new blisses, new contrasts. You know.
Yeah.
So we were. I wanted to mention this. Last couple of sessions, he's been every now and then. Like once a session, he'll go. Then there's Jack Sarfatti, and he's been mentioning Jack Sarfatti for some reason. But I haven't had a chance to get into it.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm reviewing number 32 today, or last couple of days, session 32, May 7th, and. We bring up Jack Sarfatti. I bring up Jack Sarfatti, and Ion does his first talk about Sarfatti. And I go, that Ion, he knew that I would be hearing Sarfatti in session 32 today.
Mm-hmm.
So he was teasing me, because as soon as I heard it, I said, oh, okay, I got some questions about Sarfatti now. But he knew a couple days ago and was throwing in Sarfatti out of the blue, knowing I was going to bump into him, then I'd be ready to go into it.
Yeah.
So that's pretty neat. And the other thing is, we had this amazing session with a banking guy, private client.
Mm-hmm.
All right? You know, a banking trader kind of thing. And it was fucking incredible. Ion did all this stuff about the guy's job, went into the details, the actual financial talk, and then told him what was coming and this and that and why that his bank is doing this. It was unbelievable. And then he threw in there in the middle... Oh, but he says, and your mother, who's a nurse practitioner, blah, 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 blah. So at the end of the session, I said, so-and-so, is your mother a nurse? He goes, yep, nurse practitioner. So I said, so Ion had the ESP on that? And he goes, yep. And then he said, yeah, the ESP and a lot of other stuff, too. He's a fucking monster, man.
Well, I wonder if Ion is your non-physical.
Yeah, it's... I evoked Ion in some way. Ion talks. We wouldn't know Ion unless we had a non-physical. So if you engage with Ion, you've got non-physical. You know, everybody is non-physical. So I don't know how much it's me or everybody's non-physical.
Mm.
But the... This may be a modern form of invention. I invented ion.
Hello?
Can you hear me?
Hello, Bob?
Yeah, just a minute. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay, I just got out of range or something. Mm. I was saying that this may be a modern form of invention. I invented ion.
Ah. Well,
co-creation, you know, some kind of weird co-creation.
Well, the ion, the foundations for ion have been being laid for a long time by channels, including
by
evergreens.
A lot of things, and especially the channels I've been involved in.
Yeah.
But the, it's, more you hear ion, it's the Church's of Jesus philosophy, slack, relax and allow.
Right.
And, you know, here's an amazing thing. I heard him say, he said for short, relax and allow RNA. And I said, oh, yeah. He said that Dan Winter left out the RNA. And that's RNA, but also RNA in relation to DNA is relax and allow.
Yeah, I don't get the heavy reliance. The RNA, the DNA holds the genes in order, and the DNA and the RNA just comes and grabs stuff. It takes an impression from the DNA, and then it moves it over and uses it to build something.
Think of it as a tactile interval. It's the thing molding.
Well, the DNA is the blueprint. The RNA goes and it gets a piece of design from the blueprint, then it goes and takes it to whatever it is it's building, you know, and uses it, and then, you know.
It's massaging. You see, that's tactility, the thing that takes the sensory data and molds it into coherency. RNA is doing the work.
Mm.
It's active in the interval.
Right.
It's the messenger. So,
I don't know if you've talked with Ion about this, but there's been some really good work in the lab to indicate that evolution also works in reverse in terms of the survival of the fittest and natural selection acting on the genetic turning on and off of genes and configuring of chromosomes and all that kind of stuff, that the way that we actually think of, feel about ourselves can have an effect on turning on and off genes.
Yeah, isn't that Bruce Lipton stuff?
Yeah.
I could. That I would agree with that. I think definitely the body. See, that's just the physical. See, all the sciences only have the physical. They don't include the non-physical.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't include the way the mind filters that, and plays around, screws it up. Like how you feel about it can include the rules of your mind.
Oh yeah, and may only refer to the rules in your mind.
That's right. So if you relax and allow your rules, and you don't have any rules, then anything can happen, and then you can...
Well, you can't not have any rules, because you already said you can't get rid of any rules.
Yeah, that's what I said. You relax and allow in your rules, and somehow do that mental trick where you allow more stuff to happen beyond your rules, then you can make your body do all kinds of things.
Yeah.
And Ion says belief is a part of it. You have to believe yourself into these things, and that's relaxing, allowing the rules you already have.
Right.
You add on a belief, so to speak.
Right.
So it's an ongoing tactile juggling of this of the Trinity.
Mm-hmm. And the unmanifest is the Holy Ghost.
The unrealized creations are what you spill back into the guff.
If you ever get there.
Yes, if you ever get there. Which is a new idea.
Yeah, but he goes into that in the third one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He goes into what is a factor in whether you get there or not, or how you get there.
Yeah, because you could get stuck in some nightmare scenario on the way to the Gulf and never get to the Gulf.
It's not a nightmare. You could do that, but you don't have to, because everybody feels the same bliss when they die.
Yeah, eternity feels the same.
Yeah, everybody gets the bliss. It doesn't matter what you did or who you are.
Yeah. So, and if you're in eternity, it
Which
seems like
no time. You can't tell where anything.
There's no time. So, do you still have an imagination?
I don't know, but he does say. He does say that you, the way you feel right now, or the way you look out on the world, that same thing is looking out in the world in the bliss zone.
Yeah, but without all the encumbrances of...
Yeah, you mean, I don't know, what'd you say, imagination? Was that your question?
Yeah, I wonder if you still have imagination.
Visualization that comes out of contrast. I think what happens when you're... When you're in the guff, you see all. I don't know if you see it all when you're before you're in the guff.
Well, you know,
nothing to imagine. You see everything.
Yeah, but you know, McLuhan's imagination is that which is not
embedded
within any of the senses.
Right.
So your sense, your body, and your physical sensory matrix is gone. Are you still have an imagination?
Well, you mean by that, do you still have detachment? And I think it is the detachment we were just saying. The thing that looks out, it's not embedded.
Yeah.
But it does get embedded, tricks itself. So sounds like imagination is the physical trying to bring in all that you can see when you're in the non-physical. Like you've been cut off, amputated from the non-physical, so to speak, even though you haven't really. And then you fill in, and that's that... The mind working in the imagination, filling in.
Yeah.
But then you could put that in just secular terms, just involving your senses. But I was just thinking of the imagination as a response to being amputated from the bliss.
You're
trying to fill in and see all that you could see when you were in the bliss.
Well, I have heard several cases, including one man that I know, who experienced. Well, a couple of the cases I'm thinking of are people who died and then were brought back, and they said that when they were on the other side, they experienced moving into the place of feeling like they understood everything.
Yeah,
but they couldn't explain it or think about it once they got back in their body.
Right. Wasn't that amazing that the whole mythology of the near-death experience, and you're going down a tunnel, and that's beckoning you to come back. Ion comes up with, I don't know if anybody's ever said this, I don't think so, that no, the tunnel you think you're being beckoned to, but you come back from, is you actually returning.
Yeah.
That was incredible.
Yeah, I know.
And then now...
You know, some ideas seem incongruent to me for some reason, and I need, like, some evidence. That's an idea that I don't need a lot of evidence for. It just sounds right.
Yeah, and look at this. If you're in the ether and you're dead... That experience is pretty hard to know in the physical. So if you actually die and start to be in the dead zone, they all say, you know, you're looking down, but you probably couldn't conceive of it. So when you come back, you make up a tunnel, a vision, or something to come back. That's where you begin to think with the human brain again. So it creates an image, a tunnel that you travel into to return.
Yeah, but and the tunnel is some composition of light and dark. Well, you have to have light and dark to have contrast, so you're moving back into the contrast.
Right.
Now, see, now in where Ion lives, I guess there's no light and dark.
No.
There's
they see something, but I don't know how they see it. I've got an eye on it's ambiguous. He's described it a bit, and then other times he says he can't describe it. It's a bit mixed up.
Yeah.
Like, I'll bring up a topic, you know, months ago. I'll get some information. Then a few months later, I might bring it up again, get that, and it might have been a bit different. Then I got to do it a third time.
Yeah.
Then I got to go back and hear it. So as I review all this, I'm picking up all the loose threads.
Right, because on the last cash flow show, he surprised you by doing a 180 and saying that we don't create the universe, at least the basic universe itself, but we somehow create our world within it.
Yeah, no, Ion said a couple months ago, he says, okay, Bob, and Carol, you're going to find that we're going to cancel everything we've said so far.
Well...
Which totally, you haven't heard, but that makes sense because everything changes constantly. Everything's flipping. And once you realize Like, he says, well, if we prove something today, tomorrow, you human perverse marvelous creators, we'll say, ah, heck with that. I want to think this today.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's very changeable. So I can understand why he has to say that. We're going to start saying some things that we said we didn't say before and may cancel out what we did say. But they had to start somewhere.
Yeah. That's right. They couldn't get you to stage two unless they got you firmly believing in stage one.
The AirSat stage one.
Yeah. So, which the air, he didn't...
When I pressed that point, hey, wait a minute, you just said we created it. And he backed off. Yeah, you're right, Bob. You remember he backed off after I pressed it?
Uh-huh.
Wait a minute. You said we create everything. And he says, yes, that's true.
No, he didn't. He said you create everything within your world.
Yeah, but then I said, but we create everything. Didn't? I pushed it, and he sort of quietly said, yeah. But it just was getting too, it probably was too complex for him, so he just backed off.
Yeah, because now this is another thing Haramine said that made sense to me, which is that when you get it about the infinite division of space, and you get I don't know how to bridge how he went from his physics to the realization that you create, when he said, I know what it was, he said, when you really finally get it, you really understand that you're creating your reality. I don't remember if he used words creating your reality or that you're creating your experience or that you're at the center. Oh, I know. You discover that there's probably a black hole at the center of each one of us, you know, and that means that each one of us is at the center of the cosmos, which means that the entire cosmos is here for me.
That's what Ion says.
Yeah, but Haramine goes one step further. He says, you know, when you realize that, then you recognize that it's also there for you and you and you and everybody else too. Therefore, there's this negotiation that has to happen between me creating my reality and you creating your reality. There's still I have to acknowledge the fact that you're really there, and I have to deal with that. I can't, you know, just wish you away because I'm creating the world and you don't really exist.
No, you can do that, but you... you have a need, maybe, to resonate, and so you only overlap with other universes that you resonate with.
Yeah.
Now, this thing about where I say to Ion, hey, you said we created the whole world, and he said, no, it's separate. That's the ongoing discussion or argument I have with Ion.
Well, see, that's the thing. You see, if I'm creating the world, I'm at the very center of it all, and it's all here for me, but that's true for you, and it's true for Carolyn, and it's true for every other human being on this planet, then maybe there's a level in which there's the fact that we collectively create something that is going to be here, regardless of whether the Scott is here or not.
I can disconnect. It's the simple idea is resonance. If you choose to vibe with what the group creates, you're in there. That's all.
Yeah.
It's a matter of choice. Now, but it does that. When he said, no, you don't create the world, the world's there, and you create your own universe, that's the same argument. Where do we begin and end, and where does the group mind come in? Where is the collective consensus?
Yeah.
What did you say, Count? It begins right here? What do you mean by that?
I don't know.
What have you been watching?
I'm channeling.
What have you been watching?
Eddie Izzard.
Oh, is he? Oh, okay. Yeah, girl's all whacked out because she's been watching comedians.
Yeah.
Good night,
Scott. Good night.
No, that's the ongoing thing. How does it?
See, something I got when I was talking with you one time, which stayed with me, I don't know, somehow we got to the point where you said, how do you know, you said about yourself, how do you know I'm not a bunch of tapes or something like that? And I said, well, I know I'm not. And you said, well, how do you know that? And I said, because I am. I mean, that's the only thing I do know for sure is that I am. I don't know necessarily who I am or what I am, but I know that I am. And then, you know, and I said that to some other people, and they said, well, how do you know that we are? And I said, well... I just grant that you are also. I mean, it's my experience.
Yeah,
so.
You made it your experience. So we're constantly negotiating how much we allow other universes into us.
Yeah.
And how much we don't know how much the mass mind happens. So I'm always sort of trying to get Ian to go into that.
Well, you always said that communication was blocking and...
Merging and blocking.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's where I started thinking that Ian getting it for me.
Yeah.
You know, it's a great summation of my stuff.
Yeah.
What Ian's doing.
Yeah.
So I think there's a bit of truth that it's...
But it's for the astral quadrant.
Yeah, astral quadrant.
See, I think you sell yourself short because there's the chip quadrant. The chip quadrant is probably as significant as the astral quadrant, as significant as the TV quadrant. But you've made Ion all significant.
No, I'm just hoiking up the astral quadrant. We haven't had any lately.
Yeah.
You know, and Ion's the only astral quadrant that can discuss the chip body and the TV body. He uses it in his language.
Well, he's learning it from you. He it wasn't natural for him, I think, to think way.
Yeah, he said.
And he still patronizes you with your little plastic box.
Oh yeah, he makes fun of our.
You know, he calls your chip body your little plastic box.
That's right, Toto. Well, that's the he's more the astral aspect of the mystery landscape.
Yeah,
Ion's if he's a monster UFO, he's a mystery phenomenon that's showing up. And I evoke that by coining, and Ion gives me credit. Says, you made it up, Bob. You're the only one on the planet that did it. You create the mystery landscape.
That's right. You added it to your chart.
Yeah, and then it came up, and then it showed up.
That's right. That chart is the mystery. That chart is that's the Holy Grail. It's
the glue on.
That's right.
It's glue on in the chart.
Ark of the Covenant. It's that chart.
Did you know glue on is in the chart, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, but it's very. It's an ongoing drama between me and Ion about how much Bob created and how much is the external world that Bob didn't create. You know what I mean?
Right.
Yeah, and that makes sense that it's pretty hard to figure it out. That's the mystery.
Well, it's impossible to figure out. The problem is, in order to slip out of the illusion of time, the mind has to be completely... obliterated or quiesced or something.
Well, there's another aspect, but I'll save that for another time.
Another time.
Yeah. And Ion makes jokes about that. He goes, you'll have to say something like that, and then he goes, oh, there's that word again. Sorry.
Right. Well, Lazarus always had that trouble. I mean, he would say, we don't have time. Somebody's going to have to tell us when, you know, we're supposed to stop because we don't know. Because we're learning to look at Jack's watch and notice that the one of the hands is pointing up and one of them's on the two, so that tells us something.
Yeah, I was the same way. You can go on for hours, for endless time.
Yeah.
Okay, so... Well, that's very good. I look forward to. It might be too late now, but you got to listen to this Eben show.
Yeah, I will.
Yeah, do you stay up late tonight?
Yeah, but I'm not going to hear it tonight. But I'm looking forward to hearing it.
Okay, so we'll get you the third one there eventually.
Yeah. Okay. Sounds good.
Okay. Talk to you later, Scott.
Thanks, Bob.
Bye.